You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein here, in for Leonard Lopate. We've all heard it before. Americans have a love affair with cars. Outside of metropolitan areas, cars seem to be essential for everyday life. In major U.S. cities, where most people rely on public transportation to get around, automobile congestion is still part of a city's life. But with rising oil prices, growing number of highway accidents, and the impact on the environment, might we begin to see a move away from the automobile age? My first guest today certainly hopes so. In his latest book, journalist Taras Grasko explores the public transportation systems in cities around the world and the impact they have on how these cities are developing. Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile, is published by Times Books, and I'm very pleased to have Taras Grasko join us today. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, given the subtitle of your book, should we assume that you would prefer that cars disappeared from our cities?
I don't think cars are ever going to disappear from our cities. They're very useful inventions. They're great for carrying loads. They're great for going to the cottage or the seashore. But I don't think they should be the de facto mode of public transportation in major cities. When you look around the world, there are about 600 million cars right now, but there are 7 billion people. And half the population of big cities like New York, Toronto, and London don't own cars. When you look at cars as a mode of public transportation, as a way of getting people to work or school, they're very popular in the south and west of the United States, but they're kind of an anomaly when you look around the world. And we're seeing in cities like Lagos in Africa, like Mumbai in India, like major Chinese cities, that when people try to emulate American freeways and suburbs, they get into trouble because cars just won't fit into those cities. So my book's an exploration of how people are trying to make transit work in various contexts, in places from Copenhagen to Moscow to Tokyo.
Now, you mentioned Copenhagen, which you describe in loving detail as a place that has more bicycle riders than any place else. What is it about Copenhagen that allows that to happen?
Yeah, it's funny because it's not a warm city. It's a city where, you know, they have really intense winters. They get snow. It's cold and windy. It's in the 30s, but still, even I was there in November, and 36% of the population get to work or school by bicycle. And one of the things they're doing is developing these bicycle superhighways where they have synchronized lights, where they have conversation lanes so you can ride abreast with another rider and just chat. It's become just a mode of transportation. And people routinely do 15 miles a day in that city, getting to work or school and back. And strangely enough, they report that they're the happiest people in the world. The people I talked to there theorized that it was because they were getting so much exercise all through the year. It's also a neat city because it does have a good system of public transportation. It's got its own metro. It's got these elevated lines. And all of the bicycles link up with this. So you can go to a train station, hop a train, and go to northern Germany or wherever. You can live your whole life without a car. They've really made the system complete. You can even use cargo bikes, which are like the SUVs of Copenhagen. You can carry 3 kids in them. You can carry a week's worth of groceries. They're these great bikes with these cargo bays in the front.
And was one of my favorite images that you wrote about. I wondered, though, where do you put the kids? Right in the cargo part?
Yeah. Well, it's like a tricycle, and the cargo bay is beneath the rider. So the parents are kind of looking down on the kids, and the kids are being ferried around very happily in these things. I want one of these. I've just had a son, and we got to get one. They're a little expensive, but they're hugely popular. About 25% of families with 2 kids or more in Copenhagen have one.
So you mentioned that you have a son, and I know you dedicate your book to him. Can you tell us the story, because you don't own a car from your book, how your son was born after a bus ride. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's true. I'm a regular rider of the 80 bus, which goes down Park Avenue here in Montreal, and we were going to the hospital for a routine ultrasound, and it turned out that my wife's amniotic fluid was low, so we had to stay. So I think we're probably some of the few people in the world most people spring for, you know, a taxi or an ambulance, that kind of thing, when they're going to the hospital. We're some of the few people who actually got there by public transit. We did take a car home. They won't let you leave the hospital without a car seat, of course.
And you can't put a car seat on a bus, I guess.
No, believe me. I think that cars are an essential part of urban mobility. I don't own a car, and I've managed to do that through my life because I've lived in cities that have great transit systems, and I've deliberately sought out neighborhoods like row house neighborhoods. I live in sort of a Victorian row house neighborhood called Mile End in Montreal. But there's so many neighborhoods like these in American cities, whether it's Boston. I go to Philadelphia, for example, which has a huge collection of row houses. And all of these neighbors were built around their rail systems and around transit. And they're great candidates for urban revival. A lot of them were neglected. A lot of the people fled from them up until the 1990s. But there's this huge inversion happening right now where young people in particular who are not averse to transit are flocking back to cities and riding the subways. Everywhere I went, I saw the millennials, you know, with Kindles, with iPads, with iPhones, getting transit information from, you know, their wireless devices, but also just reading books on things. And they're the ones who are saying, we don't want to live in suburbs anymore. We want to go back to the city. And baby boomers who are now retiring are expressing a lot of interest in returning to transit-served central city areas and small towns. What people are fleeing is the car-dependent suburbs, and that's a huge change in North America. And that's why I think this transit trend has legs. In New York, you've got 1.6 billion people riding the subway now. There haven't been that many people on the subway since after World War II, when ridership was at its peak.
And when you say that figure, what does that mean? 1.6 billion rides or actual people who are in different
people? 1.6 billion rides per year, of course.
Rides per year, okay. I was thinking, that's a lot of people to bring into this neighborhood. So,
No, but they measure it by rides. And across the nation, transit ridership is at, I think, a 54-year high. So people, and at the same time, vehicle miles traveled, the amount of distance people cover in car, which is how governments measure car dependency, is at a low. It's been going down since the mid-decade. So there's a real urban revival going on, and transit is benefiting from this. And people are just finding transit more pleasant than it used to be. I mean, it was bad in the 80s and 90s. Things were falling apart. Now the New York subway is air-conditioned.
Mostly,
you're building 13
yes.
miles of new subway lines. The Second Avenue subway might actually be complete within, you know, by 2016, which will be a fantastic change.
You write about this, and this is something that's definitely true in our area here in New York. I know I rode the train in this morning from New Jersey, and we waited for 15 minutes in the Meadowlands for other train traffic to go by, in part because the new train tunnel that was planned was killed by New Jersey's governor.
There is
still a struggle. There is perhaps always a struggle between saying, let's put more money into roads, even in congested areas like ours, and let's put more money into mass transportation.
It's become an ideological struggle, and I resent the fact that that's happened. You know, I mean, let's face it, dictators built the first highways, and the earliest subways were built by private enterprise. A lot of, you know, the Traction Trust in New York was widely hated by the populace until the system was municipalized. So it gets tied up in these sort of, you know, left versus right mass transit, which suggests sort of the tyranny of the masses. And suburban sort of sprawl has become to be associated with Republican and the windshield perspective. I don't think we can look at things that way. We have to look at it from the point of view of mobility and what works. What works in cities, what delivers people most efficiently to cities, are trains and buses and subways. There's no question about that. And that's the reason that only 5% of people get to Lower Manhattan, 5% of commuters get to Lower Manhattan by car. Everyone has figured out that you have to take transit or you have to walk or bicycle now with city bikes, I hope. So I think we should stop looking at it as left versus right, as freeways versus subways, and start looking at it as mobility. What works in the city? And there's another thing. I mean, everybody who buys a car, who uses a car, believes that they're gaining some incremental amount of freedom. The problem is that they're sort of detracting from the freedom and the enjoyment of the city of everyone else. And the most precious thing, in the case of a tragedy of the commons, the most precious thing that the city has to offer is public space. I like what New York is doing now. I like what Janet Sadik Khan is doing in returning places like Times Square or opening up Times Square to pedestrians. The High Line is a neat thing. All of a sudden, there's this thirst for public space that we're seeing. And when you restrict the amount of cars in a neighborhood in the city, all of a sudden the city becomes more livable and public space thrives. And the way to support that is with transit and bicycles and encouraging walking, too.
I'm speaking with Taras Gresko. He is the author of Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile, and it's from Times Books. Now, you make a very strong argument for transit, and you just mentioned something which I think is key, which is walkability as well. You describe public transit outside of Portland, Oregon, and you describe an intentional community there where there was a new train station, but in order to get to it, you have to cross five lanes of highway and a giant parking lot. And so this particular train station, which was meant to be a hub, becomes a kind of afterthought in most people's lives.
Yeah, this was a Orenco station, and it was billed as the first sort of suburban transit-oriented development. It links to downtown Portland with all of its great amenities and bookstores and food carts and microbreweries with the MAX system, which is sort of half streetcar, half light rail. The problem is that the people who live in Orenco Station work at the Intel campus, which is in the suburbs. And the only way to get there realistically is by car. So the people I talk to there, only a tiny amount of them actually use the MAX streetcar in order to get to work. So it had very limited effects. And also, although it sort of looked like it was strange, it was sort of like Boston Back Bay architecture of row houses in the pine forests of the Northwest. It was walkable to a degree, but it was still sort of that typical suburban thing where you're crossing big boulevards and, you know, waiting for lights to change, that kind of thing. So I situate hope in the older cities, in the cities that have, that were built around streetcars and suburbs. Most of the metropolitan areas on this continent are now suburban. Although 50% of the population lives in cities and small towns, 80% of the actual area, the surface area, is suburban in form. So we have to look at ways of either increasing density in suburbs, and we're seeing things like Walmarts being turned into public libraries in Texas. There's all kinds of new urbanist developments that are introducing walkability into the suburbs. Or another thing to do if we want to reduce car dependency is to really rationalize bus service in the suburbs. Look at models around the world where they're doing it well, like Bogota, Colombia, for example, where they use feeder buses to link into their bus rapid transit system, which serves the downtown. Or in a lot of American cities, linking really good bus service. I'm talking about fast-loading buses, comfortable buses that go frequently in direct routes, and linking them to existing commuter rail or downtown rail systems. And that can be done. We're not going to have to wait 40 years for that. If a city really puts its mind to do it, it can do it in a couple of years.
You know, it's interesting you talk about buses. Growing up, I lived in a suburb where you had to take a bus into Port Authority, which was not a very pleasant experience. And so when we had to move to the suburbs for financial reasons, we chose a suburb where we could take a train. And you write a lot about your own distaste for buses. But it's interesting that you now bring it up as a possibility for ways to improve public transportation.
Well, in my defense, I start the book by talking about the stigma of being a strap hanger. Margaret Thatcher said any man over the age of 26 who rides a bus can be counted himself as a failure. And I start the book by saying, I admit it, I ride the bus. I do, several times a week. I dislike buses because I find too often they're second-class vehicles. Even though they're carrying hundreds of people, they sort of have the same rights as a car. And they can be the slowest things in traffic or the thing holding up the traffic. in researching the book, I think my attitude changed because I went to cities around the world that are actually using buses the way they should. Now, Curitiba in Brazil, Bogota in Colombia, they've turned their bus systems into sort of subways on the street where you pay in advance, you shuffle on like you just walk onto a subway because they don't collect fares, and you're off. And they've got these great stations on the street with sliding doors that work like subway stations. So there are other examples of that. There's the SBS service in the Bronx, which could be done a lot better, but it's a start. And Los Angeles has its Orange Line, which functions very well. So there are tentative starts to this, but very few in the United States right now. And I think, I can see the potential of buses. It's not my favorite form of transportation. I love high-speed trains. I love riding the Acela. I love even more riding Europe's fantastic high-speed trains or Asia's Shinkansen or maglev trains. But we've got a long way to go before there are many of those in the United States. So we'll see what happens. Buses, I've come around to the bus. I'm a proud bus rider now.
I'm speaking with Taras Gresko about his book, Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile. It's published by Times Books, and we'll have more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Taras Gresko, the author of Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile, and it's from Times Books. Taras, you went all over the world to look at various urban and suburban transit systems. What was your biggest surprise as you traveled?
My biggest surprise? The one I really had to see. The one that I loved was Moscow's metro. It was surprising because they were built as palaces for the people. And some of these stations, they look like sort of Liberace's basement ballroom, but if it had been designed by master propagandists, there are these gilt chandeliers hanging from the ceilings. And Muscovites love the metro because it's the one thing that keeps on working. They have some of the worst traffic on the streets above, but the metro keeps on working in all circumstances. It handles 9 million people a day, which makes it one of the busiest in Europe. My biggest surprise, I guess, though, was how little things made a difference. Mm. I talked about cargo bikes in Copenhagen, but I saw little examples of really inventive urban mobility matched to urban form. I'm thinking of Perugia in Tuscany, which is this little hill town, which has this mini metro. They had a huge problem with tour buses coming up to the center of the city, and they invented this thing called the mini metro, which takes 10 passengers at a time. The cars come every 10 minutes, and they kind of take people all over the town up along these sinuous tracks. Looks like a little people mover, but it actually works a lot better than that because it helps the people of Perugia do their shopping, get to school. It's very well fitted to the city. And other little things were surprising, too. Hong Kong, for example, has the mid-levels escalator system. This is a system that takes people up, I think, three-quarters of a mile on dozens of escalators. They go down in the morning, and then in the afternoon they turn around and go up. And you're kind of going past Mahjong parlors and bubble tea shops, and you're taking in the whole city scene of Hong Kong. It's a great little form of urban transportation. And the last one that really surprised me was in Trondheim in Norway. They have the bicycle escalator. Trondheim, like a lot of these Scandinavian cities, people get around by bicycle, but Trondheim is particularly hilly, and that's one of the criticisms addressed at Amsterdam and, Copenhagen. Well, they're flat. It's easy to cycle. Trondheim, they solved the problem by inventing this bike escalator, which is basically sort of like a little lift where you put your heel on a constantly running band, and it sort of lifts you and the bike up the hill, sort of like a very simple ski lift. So for me, I was constantly being surprised by how cities were discovering alternatives to the cars, to the car as a form of public transportation. Sometimes it seems easier than it is in North America because European and Asian cities are denser. They're more walkable at their cores. But I found lessons in all of them that could be applied to our cities.
You know, as you describe these things, the escalators for people, the elevators for bikes, are these things, though, that can be scaled to much larger cities? And also, how much do these sorts of things cost?
Oh, well, they're incredibly cheap compared to freeways and highways and the externalities of freeways and sprawl, which are enormous in terms of their environmental impact. They're actually very cheap. Setting up bicycle infrastructure, when I talked to people in Copenhagen, they said, it's just fantastic. You make the bike lanes and you maintain them. And that's it. People use them. You don't have to pay for expensive metro trains and upkeep. If you can actually encourage it, that works very well. It's true the solutions that we're talking about were elegant little things for smaller cities. But I think it's all of a piece. Bogota, for example, is a city of 8 million people. It's in 3 years, solved this incredible mass transit problem. Before, they had little mini buses, privately run, that clogged the streets, caused massive pollution. An enterprising mayor, Enrique Peñalosa, decided to set up this bus rapid transit system, Transmilenio, these red buses. And in the space of 3 years, he set up a very effective transit system that gets people to work and has caused a polluted and congested city to work once again. And the nice benefit of that is it's gone hand in hand with a real increase in desirable and enjoyable public space. They built plazas alongside the bus stations. People are now strolling in places where, you know, cars would park on sidewalks. So I think it's all of a piece. If you get cars were some of the original things that undermine the livability of cities. New Yorkers know Robert Moses and they know Jane Jacobs. Robert Moses, with incredible effort and a lot of money, managed to wedge the private automobile into Manhattan and made it possible to get around that way. I think that was a mistake. And we're undoing the work of Robert Moses and his generation now. All of the people who are so enamored of the power and the romance of the automobile. That was very 20th century. We're seeing a real change now. And I think that this can happen in North America. Actually, I'm seeing it all over. There are 24 cities in the United States, from Honolulu to Salt Lake City to Portland, the usual suspects, but also Charlotte, that are building light rail. Some of it's better designed than others, but it's part of a trend. There's a desire for walkability, there's a desire for livability, and there's a desire for the public space that transit brings.
You know, I didn't own a car myself until I was in my mid-30s and moved out to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And that was part of it, that in cities like New York and Philadelphia and even Washington, D.C., where I lived, it was possible to get around without your own set of wheels. But once you get beyond those, it's pretty difficult to be able to go through your daily life without a car.
Oh, yeah, and I'm not blaming people in smaller towns and rural areas for owning cars. I think it's totally necessary. The big idea behind Strathanger is that we're now an urban planet. 50% of the population lives in cities, and that happened in 2008. That number is just going up. So if it's true that urbanization is going to continue, if it's true that the millennials are enjoying cities and moving there, if it's true that baby boomers are choosing walkable small towns or central cities as they retire, then we've got to do something about the situation in the cities. And it's already happening. I mean, we're seeing this in the desire for public space that the streets commissioner, Janet Sadik Khan, is bringing about in Manhattan. We're seeing it in all kinds of ways. And I think people are kind of saying, you know, why did we hand our cities over to the cars? Was it just to make it more convenient to get to the suburbs? We got to reverse this. And cities are starting to tear down their downtown freeways. Seattle is doing it. New Haven is doing it. And Philadelphia is considering it. So it's true that in outside cities, you're always going to need a car. That's sort of a prerequisite for life on this big continent. But in cities, it's time to rethink what we're doing.
One city which may have a particular challenge with dealing with its freeways is Los Angeles. And you write about Los Angeles. What did you find when you explored there?
Los Angeles is a really interesting example because everyone says, oh, Los Angeles, it's hopeless, 17 suburbs in search of a city, blah, blah, blah. All of the old put-downs. I like Los Angeles in many ways because it was actually formed by the railways. It was formed by the Santa Fe. It was formed by its interurban, the red cars, and its yellow cars, which were the streetcars. Everything was linked by this rail network. course, the freeways started being built, the first one in the 30s and then in earnest in the 50s, and they became the boulevards and avenues of Los Angeles. But Los Angeles now, there's a real hunger for improving the city. They've got a mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, who has actually convinced the people to vote for a half-cent regional sales tax, which is going to bring $30 billion to build transit improvements and a subway out to Santa Monica. This is incredible, along Wilshire Boulevard. There's a lot of opposition. There are people who don't want the subway going under the streets, but it looks like it's going to get built. So I was impressed by public transit in Los Angeles, you know, where it says nobody takes the bus, that's the loser cruiser, blah, blah, blah. But actually, I saw sides of the city that were completely new to me on its light rail system, which goes down through South L.A. and goes to East L.A. and Pasadena. It's a city that has real potential, and because it's a city that is 50% Latino, that's a city that is, you know, where a lot of people are transit dependent now. There's a real public will to build out this system, and I think that's going to happen there, and good for them. So people dismissed the real basket cases, I think, are the cities that were whose growth happened almost completely after the Second World War. I'm thinking of Phoenix, which I visited in the book. It's completely centered around freeways. Its whole, it has no center. It's all predicated on suburbs and sprawl. There's a very small center, and they've put a modern light rail system through it, but it spends most of its time rumbling past tumbleweeds and cacti and endless surface parking lots. So there are some cities that may be foredoomed to automobile dependency, and we'll see how they do in the decades to come. I think Los Angeles, the second city in the United States, has real potential though.
When you talk about Los Angeles, and I think about the time I've spent out there, and I think about a lot of these issues, is there a kind of economic issue, too, that there's a set of people who can afford cars and can get around even if it's tough, and there are a set of people who can't afford cars and maybe don't have the wherewithal to be able to encourage their cities to put in more public transportation?
Right. Well, it depends on the place. It depends on the climate. I mean, I make you've got Bloomberg, who's called the strap hanger mayor, and maybe as often as twice a week you actually get on a subway.
Although you do note that he may not get on it the entire ride.
No, I know. There's SUVs chauffeuring for about 25% of the trip, but the Lexington line can be fast, and there are I think in major cities like London, Toronto, New York, it's just more efficient to take public transit, and that stigma doesn't exist. In the cities of the West and the South, it's a class and a race thing, and it's a question of time. In a lot of cases, you are spending more time on public transit, and the people who are well off don't want to do that. There's also a split between rail and rubber. I found that in Philadelphia in particular. The regional rail, the commuter rail, the old main line, as in the Philadelphia story, is where the upper class live, and they still ride it into work. The buses are for the city's poor, and there's a real class and racial divide that's immediately obvious when you switch from bus to rail there. So there are all these things. I mean, my hope in a lot of the societies I've been to where there is sort of a large middle class, larger than the United States, and there aren't such big gaps between rich and poor, you find everybody riding transit. And that's what people, Americans, say when they go to Europe. Well, your societies are different. That could never happen. You know, I'm going to stick with my car. It's more comfortable. That's true, but I think there is a change going on, and we'll see it first in the biggest cities.
You write also about an age issue, and you cite a study that says that New York is one of the best places to live if you're over 65 because of public transit.
Yeah, it's interesting. About a third of the people on this continent just can't use cars. They're too young, they're too old, they have some kind of disability. So essentially, we're saying, well, freeways and suburbs, we've built you a transportation system that serves whatever, 70% of the population, but the rest of everyone else is going to have to get chauffeured or find some alternative. That doesn't seem equitable or just to me. New York, of course, it's changed around a lot recently. It's the life expectancy in New York is a lot longer than it is on the rest of the continent, whereas 20 or 30 years ago, that didn't used to be the case. It's also a lot richer. It's interesting that the wealthy are now willing to ride public transit in the Northeast, and they're willing to ride trains like the Acela because it's comfortable, because you get a little bit of exercise, because every transit trip begins and ends with a walk. And I can see the baby boom generation discovering the joys of public transportation, just as, you know, when they were younger, they were in love with Jack Kerouac or Bruce Springsteen and the whole romance of the road. I think there might be a real rail revival on this continent, and it's going to be both for the left and the right, because conservatives, you know, have this certain hankering for old town rail America too. You know, the romance of the rails. We'll see what happens, but I'm hopeful. There are ambitious plans out there from Amtrak to expand their network. We'll see what actually gets built. It's a little frustrating when you compare it with what's going on in Asia. For example, Shanghai has built the world's largest subway system. 260 miles in the last 15 years, whereas New York has only managed to add 13 miles. We got a lot of catching up to do if that's the future that we want. We don't want the entire Chinese future, but it would be nice to see some alternatives to freeways.
Well, we have been talking a lot about rail in urban areas, but I just recently took a train trip to Williamsburg, Virginia, and it took way longer than it was supposed to, and it was the same train that you might take on a shorter route. And I read about your journeys in both in Europe and on the Shinkansen, which is a train I've ridden, and thought, is there even a possibility that this country might think about long-distance travel on the ground rather than in the air?
Yeah, it is a little depressing when you go to Spain, where if the AVE is more than 5 minutes late between Barcelona and Madrid, they give you a full refund. And we've got trains that, you know, have 100% sort of tardiness records. The Acela is very good. California is building, is well on the way to building a link between Los Angeles and San Francisco that could cut the journey to 2 hours and 20 minutes. I think there's all kinds of potential on the eastern seaboard and in the west, up the west coast. 70% of the population lives within 50 miles of the coast, so that's a natural, as is the Midwest, which has population densities similar to Spain. And there are a lot of cities that are within about 500 miles of each other, and that would be that's a great distance for high-speed rail. At this point, I don't see that happening as much as I'd like it to. I do think the California, I think the Acela will be expanded, and I think the California train's going to happen. But it's a fond dream, and, you know, maybe in the next 20 or 30 years we'll see some improvement. But for now, we are kind of wedded to the freeways. I look for hope in urban areas right now, and anything else is just sort of icing on the cake. If you can get from New York to Washington in 90 minutes, that would be fantastic. And there's hope that will happen sometime.
I'm looking forward to that day. I've been speaking with Taras Gresko about his book, Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile. It's published by Times Books. Taras, thank you so much for joining us today.
That was a real pleasure. Thank you.